Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll hear the final part of a brilliant talk by Glenn Ford. Today, Ford's focus is on U.S. policy in Africa. What he shows isn't pretty, but it sure makes sense of things. I hope you'll stay tuned. Let's catch the final 15 minutes of Glenn Ford's excellent talk on U.S. foreign policy. He gave this talk at Trinity College in Hartford on April 6. A quick recap of the first parts of the talk. Wall Street has sold off most of America's manufacturing industry, so America can no longer compete in the world's markets for manufactured goods. Losing manufacturing power has made us lose financial power. And the financial industries of the Third World also are rapidly overtaking those of the U.S. and Europe, especially the industries of China. The U.S. government always devotes itself to increasing the profits of the giant corporations headquartered here. But it has only one tool left that can do this, and that is its gigantic military machine. So the U.S. is fighting wars, directly and indirectly, seemingly everywhere and without end. The pretext for going to war throughout the entire Third World is protecting the American people from Al-Qaeda. The real reason is to contain the economic growth of China by controlling China's trading partners. Or so argues Glenn Ford. Now, in the 1950s, when it was a financial and manufacturing powerhouse, the U.S. found it expedient to play up the principle of national sovereignty and the principle of international law. The U.S. violated these principles regularly, but usually covertly. Now that we've lost economic clout, now that we have only military clout, but lots of it, our government is explicitly rejecting the ideas of the sovereignty of any other nation, rejecting the idea of international law. As one result, the U.S. bombs the hell out of Libya and overthrows its government. And Obama denies we were at war with Libya, denies even that we were engaged in any hostilities. Apparently, bombing the hell out of another country is just peaceful diplomacy these days. War, whether you call it war or not, always leads to the destruction of civil liberties at home. And we're seeing plenty of that, too. And it's all about protecting corporate profits by trying to stop the economic expansion of China. So argues Glenn Ford. Last week, Ford focused on nasty U.S. actions in Haiti and then in Libya. Today, he'll focus on our military infiltration of almost the entire continent of Africa. One last note, the recording engineer lost a few words of the talk in a couple of places. I'll mark these places with a pluck sound, like that. Here is Glenn Ford.
And President Obama tells the United States Congress that there is no reason for him to report to Congress in terms of the War Powers Act. He tells the Congress that there was no war, despite tens of thousands of sorties. And there was no war because no Americans were killed. And so here we have another Obama doctrine, another layer. According to this Obama doctrine, it does not matter how many people the United States kills. It does not matter how many regimes are overthrown. It does not matter how much firepower, how much force is applied on someone else's soil. There is no war unless Americans die in the process. I cannot think of anything that is a greater violation of the very idea of law in the conduct of nations. If I have the technical and military means to kill you without myself being injured, then I have every right to do it, and we won't even call it a war. We won't even call it hostilities. And his administration spokespersons actually said that no state of even hostilities existed between the United States and Libya. If that is not a methodical attack on international law, I don't know what is. In terms of Syria, we see the same attempt to achieve regime change simply by declaring a government to be against the interests of its people. What a blank check the United States gives to itself. All it has to do is make a head of state, a government, a boogeyman in the eyes of the American public, which is always eager to make any Arab head of state a boogeyman. And then the United States is free to take whatever belligerent actions it chooses against that state. There is no consideration whatsoever for the sovereignty of nations. The drone warfare is from that same case file. It's very much related to Obama's position that if U.S. personnel are not killed in a conflict, there are no hostilities. And so you send unmanned drones, who, of course, cannot become casualties. And not only does the American public not get excited because, well, there's no body bags of Americans coming home, but somehow that does not constitute the kind of violation of international law that an armed aircraft would. It is an extension of the U.S. declaration of war. And you see here, here language actually fails us. The United States, these two administrations, the Bush administration and the Obama administration, use this umbrella of "we are at war" to justify all manner of previously illegal actions, simply saying "we are at war." At the same time, they deny they're at war, as in the clear war against Libya. Drones accomplish that same kind of never land, and a situation that we cannot describe in conventional language. To U.S. policy overseas, then it must also be an impediment to domestic rule. And so we see that under the Obama administration, the Congress passes a preventive detention law. I don't believe that the Bush administration could ever have passed such a law. I don't think it believed it could have passed such a law, which is why it never tried. But with the assent of a Democratic president, the opposition that one would expect to preventive detention, that is, Democratic opposition, collapsed. And now we have a situation in which the rule of law of due process no longer exists in the United States. And if you don't think so, then just listen to your attorney general. Eric Holder explained that the National Defense Authorization Act's the preventive detention provisions did not violate the due process provisions of the Constitution, of the white and respectable kind, have not been thrown in jail without trial or charge. And therefore, in a political sense, and I'm using the term political loosely, it has not been tested. But that does not mean that the rule of law and of due process still obtains. I didn't mention, in terms of describing the international situation, what the United States has done to destroy any coherence of the rule of international law in Africa. It's been quite methodical. The United States, through its newest military command, AFRICOM, now operates under a doctrine called soldier to soldier. AFRICOM's objective, its mission, is not to plant a bunch of big U.S. bases around the continent of Africa. Such bases would only be magnets for protest and opposition. The real mission of AFRICOM is to subvert the militaries of Africa, to create a situation in which the militaries of the various African countries actually have ties of allegiance and dependence to the United States military that are stronger even than to their own governments. The United States in Ethiopia, for example, which is one of its closest allies in Africa, along with Uganda and Rwanda, has embedded personnel at times down to the company level. The United States has agreements through AFRICOM with every single African nation except Zimbabwe and Eritrea, and any relations it had with Sudan are now suspended. And for this reason, Zimbabwe and Eritrea and Sudan have bullseyes on their backs because they are not part of AFRICOM, but almost every other African military is. The United States has held military exercises, joint exercises with African countries, sometimes involving as many as 35 of those countries. These nations now use and are trained by American personnel in communications gear that's used for the purpose of command and control. In other words, African militaries cannot even command their own troops in the field without U.S. equipment and the trainers that go with it. The United States this year is sending a 3,500-person brigade, previously headquartered in Fort Riley, Kansas, on permanent duty in Africa. Those soldiers are not going to be staying at some U.S. base. They're staying in what the United States calls safe communities. That means they'll be staying at African militaries' bases. They'll be staying in barracks along with or right besides African troops. This is to further subvert the militaries of these countries, and I'll get to what the real purpose of that is very shortly. The situation has become so dire in terms of any prospect for political independence in Africa or for Africa to have the capability of defending itself against U.S. interventions and incursions, that the African Union's biggest military operation, which is in Somalia, where about 17,000 African troops are involved, that Somali operation is totally paid for by the Europeans and by the United States, and it is operationally run by the CIA. So we see that the African Union itself has been suborned, made dependent upon, a tool of, an annex of the United States command in Africa. Now, what is the purpose of this? As we discussed before, the United States cannot compete with China and Brazil and India in Africa. China and Brazil and India make the kinds of deals that are attractive to African nations. The United States is not trying to duplicate that or even to try to sabotage most of those deals, because that would create hostility within African societies. What the United States is doing is cultivating the militaries in all of these countries, to the point that the United States can foment a coup d'etat, even against a military ruler in any one of those countries. Its relations with the colonels and the generals is so tight, so that the Chinese and the Indians and anybody else can do all the deals that they want in Africa, but the United States has the guys with the guns, and this will not, the theory is, the wish is, this will not result in any change in geopolitical behavior, in political alliances. So go ahead, China, continue making your deals, but we've got the military on our side. And that is also a dagger in the heart of international law. It is a methodical attempt, and quite successful so far, by the United States to establish itself within the militaries of these countries so that it can subvert these countries at will, depose, a regime change through a phone call to a general rather than having to whip out necessarily the drones. Now, as I said, and took a long time building up to, this situation that the United States finds itself in and is reacting to by its reliance on its trump card, the military, is a frightening one. We understand what the result will be. More wars, more coups d'etats, more chaos in the world. The United States has no compunctions against imposing chaos in those areas of the world that it finds it cannot directly control, and that it has especially been its policy in Africa ever since the decolonization movement. And so this is very bad news in the near term. But I think in the longer term, it's not something that should scare us that badly. It means that imperialism now has run out of options except for its guns. It cannot take the logic of its weaponry to its furthest point, that is, by attacking China, because its corporations are embedded now in the Chinese economy. It is constrained by its weaknesses to take military actions because that is the only arena in which they still maintain a hegemonic, almost, a far superior position. And that means that we're nearing the end of this journey, this 500-year war, this imperial reign. As long as we can somehow constrain our government from making the mistakes that a militaristic regime can make, even if it doesn't want to, from plunging the world into the kind of quicksand that we can't escape from. If we can just hang on a little bit longer, I believe that even at my advanced age, that it is possible we will see the end of U.S. imperialism, not of capitalism yet, but of this U.S. imperial structure, which now depends solely on one leg, and an imperialism hopping around the world on one leg is going to fall, and I think rather soon. Thank you.
Glenn Ford, concluding a fine talk he gave on April 6 in Hartford. He titled the talk, Imperialism Hopping on Just One Leg. Thanks to thestruggle.org for the original video recording. I snipped out some ums and stumbles, but otherwise played it uncut.
Articulate their message and together make a toast to the new schemes they're hatching, to the next regime they'll change, to the next nation they'll turn into a bombing range. They hyped it on the radio, newspapers and TV, the anarchists who come and destroy the city. The anarchists who come and the undercover cops, the old Chicago Red Squad and their psyops. It's the cops who bought the petrol, the cops who bought the cans, the cops who brought it home, the cops who made the plan so they got the terrorists they wanted. Now they're doing fine, they got the terrorists and they got the headlines. I wanna know who, who? I wanna know who, who? Who is the terrorist? Wanna know who, who? Wanna know who, who? Who is the terrorist? Meanwhile in Afghanistan another family is dead, wiped out in their sleep as they were lying in their bed, wiped out of existence like so many are each day. This is liberation, so they say. This is liberation. And case you are unsure, the NSA will tell you if your thoughts might be impure. While the generals fly their air force all the way across the ocean, they'll build military bases, drop bombs of all description. But if you drive from Florida to the city of Chicago to pay a little visit to Mayor Rambo, watch out for the cops who bring home the gasoline, and your apartment becomes a crime scene. I wanna know who. Wanna know who. A wedding party transformed into a pit, transformed into a graveyard for children, women, men, transformed into a graveyard for empire again, a place where terrorists are born with every drone attack, a graveyard for the Midwest boys never coming back, a graveyard for society, a graveyard for ideals, a place to bury all the hearts of anyone who feels. And at the meeting in Chicago, they'll talk of women's rights, they'll talk about the terrorists they've got within their sights, the terrorists abroad, the terrorists so near, the terrorists who grew up in a suburb around here. I wanna know who, wanna know who, who is the terrorist? Wanna know who, wanna know who is the terrorist? Meanwhile in Afghanistan, more protesters shot down by NATO troops who had to prove it's them who run this town. Show. They are in control while it all comes crashing down in the countries they stole. NATO troops committing war crimes every day, ruling over nations in the old imperial way. The lying generals in Chicago with their satellites and tanks, taking orders from their bosses, the oil men and banks, taking orders from their bosses, looking suitably enraged at terror, foreign and domestic, real or staged, whether led on by informants or just off by the war. The terrorists are meeting behind closed doors. I wanna know who, wanna know who, who is the terrorist? Wanna know who, wanna know who, who is the terrorist? Who,
was David Rovix with a kind of relevant song, Meanwhile in Afghanistan. A nice coda to a fine talk by Glenn Ford. Glenn Ford is executive editor of Black Agenda Report. That's a very good online publication that I highly recommend. And it's free. BlackAgendaReport.com. That site includes some brief audio commentaries by Glenn Ford and others, and they are well worth a listen. On the subject of Africa, here's a very recent one.
The president and his family are spending a week in sub-Saharan Africa with Senegal, Tanzania, and South Africa on the itinerary. The focus of the trip, if you believe the White House, is trade, an arena in which the United States has been eclipsed by China since 2009. China, by some measurements, now does nearly twice as much business with Africa as the U.S., and the gap is growing. It is now commonly accepted that the Chinese offer far better terms of trade and investment than the Americans, that they create more jobs for Africans, and their investments leave behind infrastructure that can enrich their African trading partners in the long haul. No one expects Obama to offer anything on this trip that will reverse America's declining share of the African market. That's because the U.S. is not in the business of fair and mutually beneficial trade. It's about the business of imperialism, which is another matter entirely. The Americans ensure their access to African natural resources through the barrel of a gun. So, while the Chinese and Indians and Brazilians and other economic powerhouses play by the rules of give and take, the U.S. tightens its military grip on the continent through its ever-expanding military command, AFRICOM. To justify its rapid militarization of Africa, Washington plunges whole regions of the continent into chaos. U.S. policies under Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama have utterly destroyed Somalia, made the Horn of Africa a theater of war, drawn the northern tier of the continent into America's cauldron of terror, and killed 6 million people in the eastern Congo. The face of America in Africa is war, not trade. Extraction of minerals by military intimidation, not conventional commerce. Washington's priority is to embed AFRICOM ever deeper into the militaries of African states, rather than configuring more favorable trade relationships on the continent. But you won't learn that from the U.S. corporate media, which chooses to focus on the $100 million cost of Obama's African trip, or to look for human interest angles on Obama's decision not to touch down in his father's homeland, Kenya. However, even that angle is too sinister for deeper exploration by the corporate press, because Kenya's absence from the itinerary is meant as a threat. The United States is angry because Washington wanted the Kenyan people to elect a different president, one more acceptable to U.S. policymakers. The Americans expected the whole of Kenyan civil society to bend to Washington's will and reject the candidacy of Uhuru Kenyatta, simply to please the superpower. When that didn't happen, it was decided that Kenya must be shunned, despite its past services to U.S. imperialism. Skipping Kenya was a warning that more serious repercussions may lurk in the future, which is a serious threat because the U.S. controls most of the guns of Africa. As the U.S.-backed warlord in Somalia said in Jeremy Scahill's excellent film, The Dirty War, the Americans are masters of war. War and the threat of war is the reality behind every U.S. presidential visit to Africa and everywhere else. Whether the terms of trade are good or bad, the declining U.S. empire will get access to the resources it needs, or thousands, millions will die. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Some short commentary by Glenn Ford, rounding out the show. And that's all for today from New World Notes. From the mean streets of Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Once again, thank you for listening. Illegitimi non-carborundum. Please support your alternative news media, and hope to see you again next week. Ciao.